You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University. Joining me today is Jordan Poss, and I almost said Jordan Peterson because I have seen your name linked with him on Facebook like three times in the last, you know, 4 or 5 days. And that is neither an insult nor a compliment, just a statement of objective reality. Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College. Is that right?
Yes.
I should have had you write that down, but I didn't. Jordan, how's it going?
Good. I think I've told a few people this, and I think if you're referring to what I think you're referring to, I probably mentioned this there. But my very first awareness of Jordan Peterson was autocomplete on Amazon.com when I was once searching for my own books. So you get to Jordan P, and it immediately wants to take you to his page.
So I think that's actually I'm going to steal Jordan Peterson for a second and use that. So the context on social media where I saw this was discussion of a Jordan Peterson episode. So it wasn't I'm not outing you as a lover or a hater of Peterson, just saying that that there was discussion of that going on.
Well, that was also in the latest Christian Humanist listener feedback episode.
Right. In which I infuriated Nathan Gilmore.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Somebody suggested it to Sectarian Review, and then it independently popped up in the Christian Humanist podcast where they said this should be a Sectarian Review episode.
Right.
Which I thought was hilarious. But yeah, I think I agree with Michael Farmer. I think Peterson is a net benefit. I have issues with him, but they're probably not the same issues most other people would have, if that makes any kind of sense. The Jungian stuff weirds me out a little bit. And the comparative religion stuff gets a little woolly, I think.
Yeah, people really like get psyched about his Disney interpretations, and I watched one of them, and I'm like, that's just kind of dumb.
I really like Jungian archetypes as a like kind of a taxonomy of personality traits and personal roles. I think if you push it any further than that, it gets weird really quickly.
I mean, everything I know about that comes from the first Christopher Nolan Batman movie. So,
yeah. I wonder if Jordan Peterson would make a great Scarecrow, actually.
There you go, DC. There's your next reboot.
I would love to hear Scarecrow with that Canadian accent.
Oh yeah, that quiet, polite.
Yes, even like he reminds me a little bit of a very Southern history instructor I had in grad school who like would occasionally say like d- or something in class, but it was like he had to like work himself up to it, like with all of his bodily effort to kind of work that out for emphasis.
I'm gonna bleep that just so people don't know what you said and wonder.
Okay. Yeah, if you ever listen to Jordan Peterson's lectures, you will probably know what mild epithet I'm talking about, but yeah, it's funnier when you bleep things.
So I'm going to steal the Peterson and use that as a segue into what we're talking about today. Okay. Would you rather spend 2 hours listening to a rabid Peterson supporter arguing with a rabid Peterson hater, or watch the movie we're going to discuss again today?
I would rather watch the movie we're going to discuss again.
Okay. I thought it was a giant turd, but maybe you had a different response to it.
I'm interested to hear those arguments, but I've listened to plenty of them and read plenty of them, so I'm more or less in the Peterson camp, you know.
I was just thinking in terms of annoyingness, like.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Yeah. Well, when we're talking about their supporters, yeah, and yeah, well, not. I feel like neither his detractors nor his supporters really get half of what he's saying.
Sure.
Which is what makes it really, really super annoying. As for this movie, I'd willingly watch it again. I'll probably get it when it comes out.
Really?
Yeah, let's talk about it though.
All right, so we're if there's no way anyone could possibly figure out what we're talking about, I guess, unless they read the episode title. We're talking about the movie that dropped yesterday, as of this recording, The Outlaw King, which is the story of Robert the Bruce, which will ring a sort of vague bell in the cultural memory of many Americans over the age of what, 30, I suppose. Anyone who watched Braveheart. When it came out or shortly thereafter, Robert the Bruce is a side character in that movie, and this movie is I don't know exactly what they're claiming. I haven't read any of the background. Claiming to be, I guess, more historically accurate or grittier or something. I don't know. But Jordan, can you, before we dig into the movie, can you tell us just a little bit about any of the history behind this that we need to know before going into it?
All right, let's leave Braveheart out of it for the time being. I feel like we'll probably inevitably end up comparing it because that's what everybody else is doing anyway.
Oh yeah.
I don't know how far back we want to take this because the English Scottish thing is very old. As for the film takes place over the course of about 3 years, from like 1304 to 1307. Which I think is probably the smart choice because that way you can explore a little bit of how complicated this situation is, and also find kind of a interesting turning point in the story, which is exactly how they tried to structure it. Whether they succeed or not, I guess we can discuss. And I liked it. I'm not totally sold on how well they succeeded at relaying the story, but it goes back to, I think, the late 1270s, early 1280s. The king of Scotland at the time died suddenly. His horse stumbled and he fell down a cliff or something. It almost, reading the early accounts of it, almost sounds like a pratfall in a Monty Python skit or something, leaving no heir. His nearest heir was a distant niece through a relation who had married into the Norwegian royal family. So they made arrangements to bring her over to Scotland. She got as far as the Orkneys, which is a archipelago just north of Scotland, and got sick and died, which created a succession crisis because there was a number of contenders for the Scottish throne since there were no really near, you know, immediate relations. You know, if you get beyond like second and third cousins, it starts to get really hairy because a lot more people start having kind of legitimate claims.
It is Scotland after all.
Yes. And, you know, mentioning that, if, on top of all of this, you've also got clan politics, and not all of these clans get along. You know, Scottish nationalism is kind of it really is a modern thing, you know, because, you know, what is good for one clan is not going to be good for another. So right. Trying, you know, I'm actually reading T.E. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom, what Lawrence of Arabia is based on right now. Hmm. And, you know, trying to unite the Arabs is kind of a similar proposition, right? You know, trying to create some sort of artificial identity that covers everybody, even though for 2,000 years they've kind of fought each other, and you know their clan identity is more important. Right. So Scotland has kind of a similar dynamic with all the Scottish clans. In order to adjudicate the dispute over who should be the new king of Scots, they actually approach and ask Edward the First, king of England, to arbitrate. So they actually go to him. This is something that they skid right over really early in this movie. Somebody says something about Edward as if he sort of intervened when he was actually asked to help figure out who should be the next king of Scotland.
Which they say in whatever you call those little words at the bottom of the screen at the beginning. They do mention that.
Yeah, like an epigraph or something like that. Yeah. But the actual dialogue kind of undermines that. And of course you could probably say maybe that's the character's mistaken interpretation, but you know.
That's probably how they told it to themselves too.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I'm skimming over a lot here, and I'm personally more familiar with the English side of this because I've read a lot more about, you know, Edward and know, his family than you know, the Balliols and the Bruces and all of those people. But anyway, long story short, Edward favored one candidate for the throne. Not all of the other Scottish lords were fine with that because they all had their preferred candidates. He basically installed a guy for a couple of years, John Balliol. That ultimately didn't work out. He ended up going into exile, and Edward took over himself, which is where you get the whole William Wallace Braveheart kind of thing. Then you get the events of this film, which picks up, I believe, again in 1304. And the opening, I guess that should be sufficient background. One of the things you've got to push back against, though, and again with Braveheart kind of sold it in, you know, to bring Peterson into it, very archetypal terms. So the characters in Braveheart talk about it as if, like, oh, the English have been here forever, and we'll, you know, Wallace at one point says to Robert the Bruce, like, you can give us what we've never had, a country of our own. And, I mean, all of these guys grew up in their own country. This is a succession dispute that has broken out in their own lifetimes. You know, it's not that big of a deal. So you've got a lot of mythologizing that's built up around all of these stories. Cut to the film, and the film opens with the really well-dramatized swearing of oaths of fealty to Edward I as the overlord of Scotland. I don't know, anything you would chip in on that? That's kind of our necessary historical background, if I think.
For the movie, I mean, this is by no means my area. My kind of primary exposure to it is in high school. I read Churchill's History of English Speaking Peoples.
Yeah, which is well written, but so historically.
So I actually went back and reread the chapters on that last night just to kind of go back to it. And I don't know that this is necessarily for the movie, but of course there's the broader context too. So Churchill, like, Edward I is like this great king for Churchill.
Yeah.
Like this great legal mind, one of the people who really founds and gets Parliament on its feet, intentionally or not. You know, I mean, it's a very just king, very, very good leader in throughout most of his career. But also, while all of this is going on, they're at war with France. And the way Churchill says it is, yes, Edward has been given this authority in Scotland, but the King of France actually has this kind of authority over Edward for various legal reasons.
Going back to his overlordship of Normandy,
right?
That cropped up in Edward's great uncle was Richard the Lionheart,
right?
And one of the big problems on Richard the Lionheart's crusade was that he was there with the King of France at the time, who thought he should have seniority because William, in addition to being King of England, was Duke of Normandy, and the Duke of Normandy is the King of France's vassal.
Right.
So you get this, like, jockeying. That's one of my go-to examples in teaching Western Civ for just how complicated these relationships were.
Well, as there's the tension with France and the stuff going on in Scotland, Edward's is sort of systematically... Churchill doesn't say it this way, but Edward is systematically dismantling any kind of native Welsh government. So
yes.
this is sort of the end of any kind of Welsh independence, whatever. So it's not happening in a vacuum. And I would imagine the Scots are seeing what's happening in Wales and thinking that's going to be us next.
Right.
So it's not like they're completely irrational.
Right. Well, and it's also worth pointing out, Edward, I'm actually, in order to prepare for this, I pulled out a book I've been meaning to read, which is a new biography of Edward that came out 5-6 years ago, and it's really, really good, by a historian named Mark Morris. The Scots have had 20 years to observe this, because this is, you know, Edward is involved in Wales before he's even king, because his father, Henry III, when Edward reaches a majority, gave him lands, and they tended to be kind of on the periphery of the kingdom in places like Gascony and northern and southern Wales and places like that, sort of out of the way fiefdoms. So he's been involved in Wales since before he was king, lost some of that territory before he was king because he just didn't get a ton of support from his dad. Henry III, the general consensus on Henry III is that he was just kind of a complete inept waste of space. So Edward is definitely learning by negative example for the early part of his life. But then when he becomes king, he immediately sets about trying to reduce Welsh resistance, recapture his lands, and then make all of Wales submit, which is a, again, like a 20-year project.
Right.
So, to your point, by the time, you know, it's not that just that this is simultaneously going on, it has been going on even before there were problems in Scotland.
Right.
And his authority is one of the reasons they approached him. But then, you know, what a wolf they nurse in their bosom, right?
Right. Or if you're Churchill, what a wise and just king, but those ignorant and unruly Scots. Although, again, Churchill is pretty generous, especially to Robert the Bruce and to William Wallace. He points out that, you know, Joan of Arc often gets the credit for inventing this nationalism thing, mm-hmm. but Wallace seems to have been there, you know, a century or so earlier.
Right.
Who makes an appearance, right? Wallace is kind of the shadowy background character at the beginning mm-hmm. of the movie.
Yeah, and apparently in the original cut they showed when they premiered it at the Toronto Film Festival, Wallace was in like one scene at the very beginning, but they cut that and kind of left him, you know, on the periphery of the story. So you see him of a sort, right?
Right.
Which I think is probably dramatically the best way to approach that.
Yeah, and it avoids having to compete with Mel Gibson, right?
I mean, right.
With what we all know William Wallace looked and sounded like.
Right.
Do you want to just give us a brief overview of the movie, aside from its historical accuracy, although we can right. certainly come back to that.
Well, okay, so the plot of the film does broadly follow the historical events, which already gives it an edge on Braveheart, if we're talking about authenticity, because Braveheart included just like completely made up things like Wallace moving like 200 miles south of Scotland to attack and sack York, which never happened. I mean, I love, don't get me wrong, I love Braveheart, but it's terrible history. So this film, Outlaw King, does broadly follow the events of that it purports to portray. It does streamline and rearrange a few things, which we'll probably talk about. It begins, though, with the Scottish lord swearing, submitting to Edward I as the overlord of Scotland in a really well done, a continuous 8-minute Steadicam shot?
It all plays out. It's a while.
Yeah, and it's real, apparently. I looked into that a little bit. You create a lot of these kind of very long single shot takes nowadays. You can do those in the computer with just right. a little bit of digital stitching. This one is apparently real. Like, they actually shot continuously for 8 minutes, which is really, really impressive. So it begins with Bruce being among a number of nobles who swear fealty to Edward. Edward appoints him and a guy named John Common to be sort of, because they're the two chief rivals for the throne of Scotland, right. They're supposed to kind of split guardianship duties of Scotland. And I can't remember precisely what their title is supposed to be. It's like protector or something. It's a title that they had also used in the original succession crisis that provoked all of this. Edward leaves, goes back to England. They also do a little bit of setting up Edward II, his worthless son, which is probably the most Hollywood aspect of the movie. Because Edward II is around, but he's really not involved in any of this, which we'll, again, probably talk about. But
he didn't swear on the dead swans?
No, he did, but they were actually golden swans. I don't know where they got the dead swans, but yeah, who knows? Yeah, and I doubt that he raged and foamed at the mouth as much as he did. Edward II, yeah, that was the performance that fell completely out of place to me. Like, I was pretty much down with most of the other actors, and we can talk about that. But the guy playing Edward II was just really chewing the scenery.
Well, like, and so was the Lord Douglas.
Yeah, but that felt right somehow.
Yeah, we'll have to. There's some myths about him that are pretty fun. We'll have to get to those.
Yeah. Yeah. So they set up Edward II to provide kind of a nice Hollywood bookend to the movie. Time goes on. Wallace, you know, everybody, you know, okay, let me stick to Bruce. Bruce goes about, you know, being the obedient vassal of Edward I, who is now the overlord of Scotland. Then one day he is in Berwick on Tweed, paying like the local taxes or something that he's collected, and messengers from the king arrive with a quarter of William Wallace. If you remember the closing narration of Braveheart, you know, Wallace had his head chopped off and his body was torn to pieces and sent to the four corners of England. We see one of those quarters, an arm and shoulder, strung up in public, which causes a lot of dismay and outrage among the populace, and also just kind of immediately leads Bruce to believe the time has come to rebel, even though in movie time it feels like it's been about a weekend. So they start to kind of organize a little bit. John Common lets Bruce know that he intends to inform Edward that his vassals are being disloyal. So Bruce murders him in a church before the high altar, which actually happened. The movie kind of bends over backwards to make it look justifiable, but even at the time, it was questionable. Bruce, did they mention this in the film or not? The Pope actually excommunicates Robert the Bruce for this, even though one of the Scottish bishops reinstates him, like absolves him of it. So they've kind of glided over a little of the church politics, but they actually included a good bit of it, which I appreciated. This kicks off the rebellion. Edward, who is sick of Scotland, in a really great line. Everybody in this movie ends up screaming at some point. Edward sends his son north to quell the rebellion. The kind of culmination of the first quarter of the film is the Battle of Methven, which I want to point out by name because my wife's maiden name is Methven. Her family is originally from there. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, of course. The Battle of Methven, in which you get the good Hollywood fire arrows, which are historical nonsense but look really cool on screen. Bruce's army is ambushed. He has to flee into the wilderness. This movie, the closest analog I thought of would be if you've made a film specifically about Alfred the Great hiding out in the swamps of southern England.
Right.
And then kind of coming back, which I think would be very dramatic. But again, they're telling a little slice of the story, almost Iliad style. So Bruce has to go into hiding. A good bit of the movie is taken up with that. His wife, who I haven't mentioned yet, his wife is English. He is married to her as part of the settlement with Edward. They have gradually come around to love each other. There's an unnecessarily protracted scene in which they tickle each other with thistles, which if you haven't
seen...
That is
both a euphemism and literal.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, anyway, we can come back to that later if we want to.
I don't know that we need to.
Yeah, it was a little silly. Anyway, they go into hiding, but they're eventually discovered along with one of Bruce's brothers who is hanged, drawn, and quartered. This is what galvanizes Bruce to come back out of hiding with like 40 men, even though they've been harried both by the English and by clans that are still loyal to Edward. Gradually begin like kind of building up a resistance movement, very, very, very slowly and in small numbers, showing how hard this kind of stuff is, which I appreciated. Because especially in our particular historical moment, everybody talks about, you know, resist, not, you know, resistance is not easy.
Right. And resistance without suffering today.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And if you study history at all, resistance movements usually end up with everybody dead, just FYI. So the culmination is Bruce has managed to come back. He's captured his own lordship, Carrick. He gets that back. His friend James Douglas is able to recapture the Douglas lands in a spectacularly bloodthirsty scene. This prompts Edward to put together an army himself, since his son has so horribly botched the whole thing, ride north to take care of the Bruce. But unfortunately, Edward falls ill and dies, and it's up to the Black Prince is way later down the road. It's up to Edward II to take over and go try to defeat Bruce himself, which he tries to do at Loudon Hill, which was fought in May 1307. And it was, even despite being horribly outnumbered, I think the numbers are sketchy, but Bruce has between like 400 and 500 men.
In the movie, it was 500 to 3,000, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And Yeah, and I think those are pretty much historians' estimates as best we can tell. And this movie, the final battle scene is very, very well staged. It's also militarily sound, which you don't get in a lot of Hollywood pictures. Bruce actually takes care to prepare the battlefield, showing some of the hard work that went into that in the Middle Ages, digging ditches, sharpening stakes, planting those, hiding them, trying to find a well-sided piece of ground. He actually takes care to protect his flanks with marshy ground, which is true to historical fact at the Battle of Loudon Hill. And it ends with, you know, a small Scottish victory. I liked the scale of this movie, too. Not everything is just, you know, huge Battle of Pelennor Fields style battles.
Right.
Instead, it's, I mean, it really is the kind of small scale warfare you really got off and on throughout the Middle Ages. It ends with this, you know, unexpected, miraculous, but small but important Scottish victory over the English, which is going to start the ball rolling for eventual Scottish independence. How's that for a summary?
That's good. The summary was much better done than the movie was, I thought. But, sounds like we might disagree on that.
Well, I have some serious misgivings about the movie, but I mostly liked it.
All right.
I think this morning I looked at Rotten Tomatoes, and the user score, or the viewer score, was, let me see.
Last night it was like 55%, but of course it had just come out. So
yeah, well, that was, yeah, okay. Critic score, the tomato meter is 57. Audience score, based on what users of Rotten Tomatoes think, is 77.
Okay.
This morning it was 79. I think 77 or 79 is about right. A passing grade, but not stellar work, if that makes sense.
All right.
So yeah.
Well, any glaring historical inaccuracies that should ruin it for us, but maybe don't.
All right. Let me say what I liked most about it historically.
Sure.
No kilts, no woad, no bagpipes, nobody tossing cabers. They get the look of the period just about right, and this is not my period, but I'm familiar with it, and I've consulted a few other sources, and generally speaking, they nail the look and the feel of the time period like really, really well.
Okay.
I mean, down to, you know, relatively small things. Most of the swords are right for the period. The armor is right. You know, you don't have tons of plate. It's still mostly chainmail and gambesons, padded cloth and leather and things like that. So, you know, you see English knights, but they're not, you know, knight in shining armor yet. The combat is really well done. And again, that last battle scene in particular is like really right for the period, and it's based pretty closely on accounts of Loudon Hill. I also like that they give you a sense of the really small scale of most medieval battles. You know, we just passed the anniversary of Hastings, and Hastings was huge for a medieval battle because both sides had around 10,000 men. I mean, this is, you know, even Agincourt, there are fewer people involved, and that's one that lots of people come back to as like a seminal kind of battle. So, I mean, a battle involving under 4,000 people is very typical. So you don't get the, you know, the kind of huge sweeping Lord of the Rings style thing. We can come back to the performances later. Most of the characters act just about right. I appreciated the film's emphasis on ritual and ceremony, because you get lots of things like swearing oaths of fealty, you know, right down to, like, I've just covered this in Western Civ, so I almost wish I could show that opening, like, 8-minute shot, because it starts with a guy kneeling before Edward I with his hands together, with Edward clasping his hands, which is how all those oaths are sealed. And I've just been talking about that. You see funerals, you see a wedding, right? Knighting ceremonies, which include the buffet, which you don't normally see, where, you know, the guy doing the knighting gives the guy an open-handed smack to kind of seal the deal. The only other movie I've seen do that is Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah, I would say that was in Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah, but that has even worse historical problems, which we, you know, maybe we can talk about that another day. So I liked a lot of what the movie has a lot going for it. It also gives you really good feel for the complexity of the politics. It's not enough to say Scotland should be free. It's like, okay, well, what does this mean practically, because
we're
all,
they never tell us.
Yeah, and, well, you kind of intuit it, because he talks about, you know, taking back the countryside castle by castle, and I've seen the figures on it. I can't remember. I mean, like something like 90 or 95% of all known medieval battles were sieges. So infantry on infantry conflict, or you know, foot battle, just on an open plain, is extremely rare, which is why it's notable when it happens. So I mean, taking back the countryside that slowly, trying to get fractious clans that don't like each other to cooperate, which they show, even if they don't show. I mean, they show what the obstacles are. You kind of have to intuit how they're going to go about solving them, and getting a battlefield right. victory is part of that process. As for the big problems, I've seen a few people point out, like, the crenellations on the castles are too small. you know,
yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, that's the kind of like, okay, you know, right. But seriously, like, real stuff. The biggest ones are where they try to go the most Hollywood with it, and I've alluded to that already, and I think that's in the writing. If this movie had better writing, I think it could be way, way better than it is. And again, I generally like it. Edward II is a problem for the movie. The real Edward II is closer to his Braveheart iteration than this guy. So, So Edward II is Edward I's son. He's not his. I can't remember. He might have been like the 13th child born to Edward or something, but only a few of them actually survived to adulthood. Edward I had a much older son named Alfonso, who died when he was 10 or 11. When Edward II was,
so we like, almost had a King Fonzie I.
Yeah, because because Edward's wife was actually Castilian. Right. So they're related to those Alfonsos. Yeah, it would have been amazing to have a King Alfonso of England. maybe they would have called him Alf. I don't know. So Alfonso dies when he's like 10 or 11, and Edward II is like a couple months old, which, you know, was kind of a, you know, serious watershed that goes unremarked at the time, because we don't know what kind of loser Edward is going to be. Purportedly, Edward II at some point said something to the effect that he would be happier as a ditch digger than the king, something like that. Right. Part of it is inheriting a kingdom that was very, very strong, but in huge debt, because Edward's wars are extremely expensive, and you know that part tends to go overlooked, along with things like medieval logistics, like how do they feed these guys, that kind of stuff. But the cost is just crazy, and I mean, half of what Edward spent his reign doing was just trying to scrape together money, which is how he got into a lot of other trouble, like expelling Jews from England and getting in with Italian bankers and stuff like that. Sorry, you're about to say something.
Where Parliament comes from, too. Right?
Yes.
I mean, that's
right, exactly.
You get the nobles together and ask them to raise money, and yeah.
And they can say no, and they often do, which pleases the anti-federalist inside me. So, just to mix our metaphors a little bit. So Edward is useless. The thing that is most famous about him now is that he is popularly believed to have been gay. There's no really firm evidence for that. He's certainly accused of it in his lifetime, because he basically surrounds himself with a lot of very, very close, intimate male favorites, regardless of whether or not they are qualified to have any kind of authority, and they're not, generally speaking. That prompts accusations that he's some kind of, you know, in medieval terms, a sodomite. We can't be absolutely sure, because he does marry, he does have kids. Edward III, who starts the Hundred Years' War, is one of his kids. What we really had to remember him for, though, is just his complete ineptitude. He just does not seem interested, doesn't seem like he can be bothered to really figure out how to run the kingdom, which causes all kinds of problems. I mean, his great-grandfather, the grandfather of Edward I, was King John, and we've almost got like a John 2.0 in Edward II. So the Edward II of the movie, though, is this like bloodthirsty, scenery-chewing, you get a really good sense of the dynamic he has with his father, because Edward I, in a couple of scenes, really wonderfully and subtly shows how just fed up and disgusted he is with his son.
And not so subtly. I mean,
yeah, yeah. There's a really great scene where they're talking about a defeat in Scotland, and the whole time Edward I is talking to someone else, he's staring a hole through Edward II, which I thought was really, really good. That motivates Edward II to go up there and be even more brutal. Yeah, he's the one who captures one of Bruce's. Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say he's you know, every jock from every 70s college movie. He's, you know, like his, yeah. Like his character is just, yeah, there is no substance there. It's just all sort of aggression and kind of stupid aggression.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And also illegal aggression.
Right.
One of the more brutal scenes in the movie, he arrives at this castle where Robert the Bruce's wife and daughter are being sheltered. And they try to rush them out, you know, into the countryside so they can hide. All of which happened, but they, you know, it took place over several days. Because Bruce's wife and daughter were eventually captured, but they're captured like somewhere else. One of Bruce's brothers is captured at the castle and like interrogated and then like strung up and personally disemboweled by Edward II on the spot, which Neil Bruce was eventually drawn and quartered, but there's like protocols for that. You know, you have, he is a nobleman. He is a vassal of the king. You know, you have to like, you know, he's actually taken back to England, tried and then sentenced for that to happen. So you almost get this sort of like Nazi level summary execution, with Edward, which is really gross and realistically depicted. But again, I understand why they truncated all of that, but it does kind of, you know, those are kind of the biggest historical problems. Anyway, I've been going on this for too long. The biggest historical problem with Edward is that he shows up at the end. Let me call Edward the First Longshanks. Okay, Longshanks, to distinguish him from his son. Longshanks in the movie dies on his way to deal with Robert the Bruce, which did actually happen. But in the movie, he dies and his son takes over the army, goes and then squanders it in this horrible defeat at Bruce's hands at Loudon Hill. In reality, Edward II was not with the army. He was bumming around off in like Kent or something, because again, he preferred that life of like leisure. He was not this, you know, angry, violent jock. Longshanks did take an army north, but he became so ill he had to stop, and died several months after the Battle of Loudon Hill. So the guy with the shaved head, who's sort of one of the king's thugs through the whole movie, that's Aymer de Valence. He was the actual leader of the army, but he was, you know, he was the guy actually in charge, and you know, there was no actual royalty present.
Right.
I see why they did that. They, you know, raised the stakes a little bit. They made it personal for both Bruce and Edward II in a way that I think is supposed to hint 7 years down the road to Bannockburn. But it just feels very artificial.
Well, and it started with the sword fight between them, right?
Yes.
And it suggested that they'd done that all the time growing up, and
right, which feels very writerly.
Right.
Like it feels so. So I think, I mean, I was again, I generally enjoyed the movie. That last battle scene was very well realized. But when Edward personally rides his horse into the marsh and emerges from the muck and starts one-on-one sword fighting again with Robert the Bruce in the same way they did at the beginning of the movie, I think I actually said out loud, "Oh, come on." Like those are the biggest things. I think you could have done something interesting, you know, with the real story, which, you know, so imagine you're Bruce, right? And you're fighting the army of one of Longshanks' most trusted subordinates, a guy who's been with him since Wales. You eke out a defeat and then you're waiting for Longshanks to arrive. And then you get the news he's dead. Right, that's a couple months down the road, but you're waiting for it, you're waiting for it, you're waiting for it, and then, I mean, you could have done something dramatic with that, but they did the more Hollywood thing, and I don't know that it wrecks the movie, but it's a blot on it, if that makes sense. I don't know. I've been talking like this whole time. What do you think?
Well, like I said, I think it's kind of a giant turd. I see your point about the costuming. It was very ornate, and I mean, I'm not a medievalist, so I have no idea if it was accurate or not. But if it was, that's great. It's sort of my feel on this is if a lot of that stuff is accurate, and if the basic historical arc is accurate, then it then I'm willing to put it in sort of the Oliver Stone Alexander category, where they've done so much accuracy that it's at the cost of it being a good movie. It ends up mm-hmm. being just kind of a slog to watch, I thought. And I think yeah. and I hopefully this is long enough into the episode I can bring this up now. I think the problem with this movie really is Braveheart. Yeah. And I think their concern was that it not just be a reboot of Braveheart. And that the problem is Braveheart was a really good movie mm-hmm. with a fairly tight narrative plot, even if it's not historically accurate, and themes right. that are compelling.
Yes.
And, you know, interesting casting, if not always great casting, although there was some cast crossover between these.
James Cosmo,
yeah.
who was awesome.
Yeah, and one of the other lords, I forget which one. It's the one when he crosses the lake and there's the lord that he meets. And that lord's like, well, I was with Robert the Bruce at Stirling or Falkirk or whatever it was.
Oh, where were you? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that guy was also one of the Braveheart okay. actors. I don't remember which one. There is that crossover there. But so yeah, Braveheart had, again, the compelling narrative. And Braveheart messed around with the, you know, we've never had our own country business. But Outlaw King never really got around to that. Like it mm-hmm. started with the there's no king and who's going to be the king, and he murders the other contender to the throne. But there's this kind of jumbled, well, he's going to be a king representing the people. Well, no, he's going to be the king because he's the rightful heir to the throne. Well, no, he's going to be the king because these other nobles are supporting him and he's fighting. And they never they mention all of those things, and there's never any kind of cohesion mm-hmm. or resolution. And you're like, well, why is he fighting? I mean, even the choice to start fighting, it feels arbitrary. And I guess if there's yeah. massive time compression here, that makes some sense. But mm-hmm. it's, you know, he's a loyal servant of King Edward, a loyal vassal of King Edward. And then his father dies, and William Wallace dies. And now, I guess, with maybe those things count as transitions, but even then it's never explained. It's like, why are you willing yeah. to fight now and you weren't last week? And why now and not next week? Like, what's mm-hmm. the catalyst here? Which, again, Braveheart cheats and creates the, you know, well, it's all of the British guys are going on sleeping with all of the Scottish women their first nights of marriage. So there's this obvious injustice that's the catalyst, and there is nothing like that. It just kind of, he wakes up one morning and is like, well, I guess I'm going to rebel today.
Yeah. The closest it comes is when he sees the display of William Wallace's arm.
Right.
You know, as a sign that Wallace has been captured and killed, and the upset that that causes, and the brutality with which the English try to suppress the kind of crowd there. Right. But that even that is like doesn't seem adequate to what he sets out to do.
Yeah, I mean it is when his father says, you know, we made this alliance with my friend Edward, and it was probably a mistake. Like that's kind of his blessing to rebel, I guess, but. Even then, it's still mm-hmm. like there's no it's not even a not smooth transition. There's just no transition.
Right.
And again, I think the problem is they don't want to be Braveheart, but because they're trying so hard not to be Braveheart, there ends up not being a coherent narrative, and they try to make up for that with gritty, bloody battles.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm not. it's fine. I mean, Braveheart was pretty gritty and bloody in the battle scene, so it's not like you're doing anything new or revolutionary there. So, despite not trying to be Braveheart, it ends up kind of being Braveheart in the, you know, the one place where they obviously put some time and effort in.
Mm-hmm. No, I see that. I think there's some behind the scenes stuff here that might. So it was originally like close to 2.5 hours long.
Sure.
And then it premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival to kind of meh reviews. And one of the things that was pointed out a lot was like poor pacing.
Okay.
So the director actually took it back to the editing bay between when it came out. I think he premiered it in like September or something, and had like a couple of weeks to trim it and cut it by 20 minutes. And from what I understand, so all that I've read by people who saw both versions said that this version is superior. It doesn't drag. It's less confusing, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
But apparently, and I had the sense when I was watching that that this might be the case, but apparently most of the stuff cut came from like the first quarter of the film, right, where you're like kind of getting the groundwork in and starting to understand the characters, particularly Bruce and his wife, because if you want real arbitrariness, I mean, the decision she kind of comes to sort of like go, you know, all in for Robert the Bruce, my husband, just sort of feels like, why, you know? Chris Pine is really good, but he's so brooding and interior, especially in that first quarter of the movie, it's kind of hard to tell like what's going on up here, right, you know, like what is motivating him. And that can be compelling, but when the situation is so confusing, you need to know what the main character is thinking. And I don't know, I feel like even though apparently this is an improved version of the movie, I did notice editing and pacing problems. Editing in particular, you can kind of tell where chunks have been taken out in a few places.
Right. Right. And I can't judge the movie I didn't watch. So, you know.
Right. Yes. Ditto. I mean, if they had released the full original thing, which apparently the director was not super happy with in the first place, I mean, we could be, you know, talking about what they should have taken out. I mean, I'd be curious to see like a director's cut or something. Or maybe just deleted scenes one of these days, but just apparently there was originally a scene with William Wallace in it.
Right.
We already talked about that.
Yeah.
I'm on a lot of cold medicine right now, just FYI.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm getting over one myself.
Yeah, when I watched that Loudoun Hill battle scene, I left, you know, when I was done, I left my office and the weather outside was exactly like it was in the movie. It's like cold and overcast and drizzly, and I was just like, ugh.
Dishes full of steaks everywhere, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. I had to walk across a carpet of horses to get to my car.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, my primary objection was there was little plot to the movie. It was a lot of him brooding and doing stuff without connecting the brooding with the doing stuff in any way that we noticed.
Yes.
As opposed to Edward II, who wears everything on his face. Like, you always know what he's thinking, I guess. So maybe there's some intentional contrast there. But then it was that, and then it was people, you know, chopping each other's heads off with swords and in particularly brutal ways, which I'm not opposed to violence in a film. I'm, you know, fine, whatever. I grew up in the 90s when Braveheart was the most Christian movie around, so, you know, I'm fine with that. I need some reason for it, and we're just never given that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can totally see that. I was about to ask you what you thought of the performances, and I think both of the Edwards kind of steal the show.
And McDougal.
Douglas, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was the thing. I really liked the Douglas character, and I felt like he went over the top in a way that I could see someone going over the top for real, given his past history. He had a little... I wish we had actually had more of him, because every once in a while he showed these little flashes of personality that made me think, oh, I want to... Like, okay, so he and Robert the Bruce are scouting out Bruce's castle so they can try to take it back.
Right.
And they're hiding behind like a chicken coop or something and watching, you know, the current occupants, you know, the English, you know, and his subordinates and that kind of thing. And then they turn to sneak away. And before they go, Douglas turns back, tucks a chicken under his arm and leaves, which is hilarious. And again, you just don't get that many kinds of flashes of irrelevant personality,
right,
you know, like the kinds of irrelevant details that make a person feel real.
Right. Or he seduces the daughter, like both the daughters of one of Bruce's other lieutenants, like screen.
Yeah.
Like you just see them.
Yeah,
right,
he's trying to clearly. Right. And the other guy's name is like Angus MacDonald, if I remember correctly.
Which is there a more Scottish name than that?
For real. And he's redheaded. That guy is a favorite face of mine. I first remember him in Gladiator, in which he is one of the two guys sent into the woods to kill Maximus.
Yeah, that's right.
And things don't turn out well for him.
Right.
Tony, his name's Tony Curran. I can't remember how exactly. Oh, so the Edwards, I mean, Edward II just, is so ridiculously over the top. Edward I, played by Stephen Delane, mm-hmm. who apparently is a major character on Game of Thrones, but I've never seen any Game of Thrones. Don't care to. He was really great, though, as Thomas Jefferson in the John Adams miniseries.
Yep.
He's really good at, again, very kind of interior characters in a way that, unlike Chris Pine's Bruce, you still can see the gears turning and understand what exactly is going on.
Right.
So he's very, very good as Edward I, and as opposed to the Longshanks and Braveheart, who's kind of wily and gleeful about kind of the way he's screwing over Scotland, this Edward is he feels a little bit more like the historical Edward I think might have been. You know, he's been doing this for over 30 years.
Right.
He's just kind of like one, you know, every time you solve one problem, there's another problem. He's just kind of doing what he can within the system as it exists to keep the peace as far as he possibly can, which is not the impression you would get from his subordinates.
Right.
But to maintain some kind of order and, you know, resolve each problem and keep England in a position where it can continue to sustain and protect itself and be powerful, which I think he sells very, very well.
Right. He clearly is not a bad king, and other than maybe his treatment of his son, which, you know,
yeah.
I don't know if that's historically accurate or not, but not a bad king and seems to want to do the right thing, but also the thing that is good for him.
Yes.
And yeah, that's. I thought the acting was fine. Again, I thought Edward was over the top, but in kind of a fun way.
Yeah.
And Douglas, I thought, was also kind of over the top, but in a way that, were I an actor, I could see kind of getting into the role that way.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
If you've got a beard that big, you've got to just go crazy at some point,
right? When your face is streaked with blood and you just stabbed a bunch of people to death in a church,
yes.
you have certain facial expression obligations that now have to be met.
Right, right. Yes. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. So since we're on Douglas, this is from Churchill's history. So Churchill says, one of the most famous stories of medieval chivalry tells how Sir James the Black Douglas, for 20 years the faithful sword arm of the Bruce, took his master's heart to be buried in the Holy mm-hmm. Land, and how, touching at a Spanish port, he responded to a sudden call of chivalry and joined the hard-pressed Christians in battle with the Moors. Charging the heathen host, he threw far into the melee the silver casket containing the heart of the Bruce. Forward, brave heart, as thou wert wont, Douglas will follow thee or die. He was killed in the moment of victory. I mean, I can see that based on the character from the movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to chuck this into the fight.
Yeah, they definitely set him up as the kind of guy you could see doing that. Well, I guess maybe to go back a little bit, like talking about kind of the complex threads they sort of tease out and then don't weave together. Like, I guess I have two thoughts here. One is that I appreciate that they acknowledge those things. Because medieval kingship, you know, we tend to assume everybody had like that divine right of kings idea, and that's actually a more modern conception of things. So, I mean, your base of support as a king in the Middle Ages was the nobility. It was your position protecting the people, and it was through your right of inheritance in most cases. So, I mean, those are all right. proper things to bring up.
In the church, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I appreciate that they acknowledge that, you know, a lot of medieval movies kind of either strip the religiosity out of their depiction or just kind of make all churchmen like these kind of cynical Johann Tetzel kind of types. you know, and probably most people were sincere in one level or another
right.
At the time. So I appreciated them including that, but I do agree that they acknowledge those things but don't really bring all of those threads together in a way that you can. They don't, I'm trying to find exactly the right way to say this.
So it's fine that is historically accurate, but that's not yes. movie accurate, right? I mean,
I guess I'm just happy to see it acknowledged in a movie, even if they don't make the most dramatic hay they can of it. And I think that's where it comes back to the writing, where at some point to try to impose a structure on this story. They went with the Hollywood thing with, you know, these bookends with Edward II and Bruce, you know, in single combat, instead of trying to kind of create some kind of compelling story out of the actual material available, if that makes sense. Right. Especially since they go to the trouble to acknowledge what medieval kingship is all about. And I had another. Oh, I guess another thought I had too, and I have wondered this since I watched it, was, you know, because I know a good bit about the period, at least on the English side, and to a lesser extent on the Scottish side. I guess one of the things I've wondered is, okay, I know what's going on. Would somebody coming to this movie who hasn't read the books I have understand what's going on? And it sounds like no, probably.
I mean, you get that he's not the king at the beginning, except he kind of is, and he is the king at the end, and then 300 years later, his descendant is the king of, you know, England and Scotland. But I mean, it's the in between is kind of a bloody muddle, which again, maybe that's just historically accurate, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean this and I like they kind of. I mean, some of these narrative problems are just the problems of the story, because I think it was wise to limit the amount of story they tried to tell.
Right.
To like three years. And, you know, tell that story of Alfred in the swamp before he made his comeback. You know, that's a discrete episode. You've kind of got a self-contained story there. But what you're going to get is a slice of this very, very complicated story in which some of the complications are not going to be resolved for a long time afterward. So, I mean, I don't know. Save me from the silence. I'm just sort of like,
no, it's okay. I can appreciate that you as a historian like the movie. I can get that in the same way that I understand why my friends who are ancient historians hate the movie Gladiator, the fall of the Roman Empire.
Oh boy,
which I think is just super tedious. But
yes.
In
addition to being basically exactly the same story as Gladiator.
Well, yeah, in some ways, I mean, it's more historically accurate.
You
have the you have the auctioning of the Roman Empire at the end and so on. But so I can appreciate that. I'm just as someone who doesn't know the history here, I can say I didn't think it was a good movie in the sense of, you know, what I guess what I tend to look for in movies. But
does it work as a movie? Not very well. No.
Anything else on the movie? Otherwise, we've been going for about an hour. I don't know that we need to add. I don't know. This should not be as long as the movie.
No. The cinematography is nice.
Yeah.
The DP managed to nab a couple of really nice rainbows in the background.
Sure.
Which, you know, it rains like 360 days a year in Scotland, so I guess you're going to get some rainbows anyway. I think I agree with most of the problems you had with it. I just appreciated a more realistic looking, more politically jumbled story, because that's what these guys were actually living through. To what I was saying earlier, yeah, they've picked a good story to tell, but some of the dissatisfactions you're going to have with the story are due to the story.
Right.
Decent performances mostly. Anything you want to say about like the marriage angle? I've seen a few people kind of like say this is some sort of proto-feminist thing or something.
I mean, it obviously was. Like she gets her little talk. I mean, I don't know if it's historically true or not, but she gets her little speech about women in my station have lots of time to sit around and read, and here are all of the political conclusions I've drawn and so forth.
Generally, I felt like they got the attitudes of the medieval people just about right, but she says something there about, you know, we don't have to be tossed on the tides of history, and I'm like, have you been reading Hegel 600 years early?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the idea of history as a thing that has tides and currents to it is just not something that entered the historical imagination of medieval people, which stuck out. I thought the actress did a fine job with an underwritten part.
Sure.
She I don't think was ever actually hung outside a castle in a cage. I think somebody in Bruce's family was, but it wasn't her. So getting back to the accuracy thing, I don't know. It was, as a film, it's got serious weaknesses. Again, for historical stuff, this is the, I guess, let this be the end. I guess as a history teacher, what I appreciate about the movie is this is the kind of movie I could have on DVD. and show like an illustrative 10-minute chunk to a class to say, look, this is what fealty was, or this is what, you know, this is what a knighting ceremony was like. Or, you know, if I had a class with very strong constitutions, this is what an actual medieval battle was like.
Right. Yeah, that is exactly the way I use the Oliver Stone Alexander movie. We're going to watch this in 5-minute chunks, and we'll see Aristotle teaching Alexander and talking about the Iliad, and we'll see, all of the other various bits and pieces that are fine. But if you sit down and try to watch it straight through as a movie, you're like, oh my God, this thing is 20 hours long.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and that's ultimately how I feel about this one. Watch it if you watch it, and I would probably recommend it. We should probably have noted earlier on, this is not a movie for the kids.
Sure.
Yeah, it's got violence, it's got sex.
The TBS edit, right?
Yeah, there you go. Get the TBS edit, or something like that. It's even got a couple of F words in it, which was one of them was used for comedy, which was kind of a bizarre moment. But you even get that in Braveheart,
right?
I agree with you. It's got serious problems as a movie. I appreciate the effort, I guess, is what I'm saying. And if you watch it with some of what we've talked about in mind, and watch it. Chris Pine is fine in it.
Yeah,
I think he's underappreciated, and he does really good work, even if sometimes he is just inscrutable. The guy who plays Douglas is great, and also watch it for a very, very good depiction of Edward I.
Again, I enjoyed Edward II, the same way I enjoy Bruce Campbell movies. You know, you got to take them for what they're worth.
If Edward II had one of his hands replaced with a chainsaw, that would have made the middle of the movie amazing.
I would change my view of this movie in a second.
That's what we need. Forget Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. We need like a Edward Longshanks and son, like Scottish zombie hunter. Something like that.
Oh yeah, some supernatural, but in the Middle Ages. There are movies like that, I suppose.
I'm sure there are.
They tend not to be great.
Speaking of crappy medieval movies, though, like I guess one of the things I very recently checked out from our library, a movie purportedly about Richard the Lionheart before he was king, when his father, Henry II, was on the throne, because he and his brothers actually, for a brief time, rebelled against their own dad. And this movie was supposed to be about that, and I could not get through 10 minutes of it. Right. There are just legions of these extremely cheap, really gory, really violent, really like Game of Thrones-style nudity delivery system kind of movies that just make their way out there. And I guess in contrast to stuff like that, is that's one reason I'm kind of appreciating this more for what it is, even if it is very flawed.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, it is still a Hollywood movie.
Yes.
So this is one of the things that in my film class we talk about. You know, like Hollywood movies, compared to most other kinds of movies, and certainly compared to a lot of the indies up until the modern world, they're usually technically super proficient. Right. I mean,
yes.
they have budgets, they have technology behind them, which means that we can focus on things like plot and follow through and so editing and so on. But there's a lot of movies out there that aren't. So.
Yes. And speaking of like your film class, to plug another part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network, Chris Gertz several years ago had a really good blog post. I think it was at Pathos.
Mm-hmm.
About historical movies. It was in response to Free State of Jones.
Right.
And he laid down four criteria for what he thought made a good historical film. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but it's a rubric that I use. You know, I had kind of intuited, but now that I have it like down in my mind, it's a good rubric for sort of judging the quality of a historical movie. And among the things he asks are, you know, first of all, just is it a good movie? This one, again, I think a C grade is about right. It's got pacing problems and editing problems, and some of the performances aren't super great. But I was entertained. Another question that he asks out of these four questions, though, is it interested in the past for the past's own sake? And I think this one is.
Right.
They don't do enough with it, but I appreciate just the effort to tell the story on its own terms, as opposed to something like Kingdom of Heaven, which is, you know, really about Bush era Islamophobia, right? I mean, that is admittedly what Ridley Scott's doing with that. So telling the story in its own terms is something I wish we had more of. And maybe if Outlaw King is as flawed as it is, maybe if it's successful, maybe we'll get more films like this.
Right. Now, is this a and we don't have to go down here again. We don't want this to be as long as the movie. This is the first movie that I have seen that does the dropped on Netflix the same day it hits theaters. Is that a common thing? And I'm just out of touch with.
It's something they're I was actually thinking about that a minute ago. It's something they're experimenting with because next weekend, the new Coen Brothers movie comes out the same way.
Huh.
Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which yeah. I'm actually more excited about than this, because I'm a Coen's nut.
I like about half their stuff.
Well, I honestly think they've made enough movies now. I think that you could make a really insightful personality test just by getting people to pick their like two or three favorite Coen Brothers movies.
Sure.
Just because so many of them are so different from each other.
Sure.
But it's this thing they've been experimenting with, and I think what was it, Annihilation, that Natalie Portman movie mm-hmm. came out back in the spring.
I think
they tried something similar there. But they're fooling around with this model as kind of a future business model, sort of like I've seen a lot of kind of competing interpretations of what exactly they're trying to do, like either horn in on theater business or sort of cut theaters out of the loop. I've seen one interpretation I think is probably more likely, which is trying to open up Netflix-produced material for like prestige awards attention. And Outlaw King is actually the first thing I saw mentioned in this context, which, if it just drops straight on Netflix, it's essentially direct to video. Right. But if you get it out in theaters, it can be considered for stuff like the Oscars. Okay. I'm sure that that's at least part of what they're doing. As far as what this is going to do for their business, I don't have a mind for that, really.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
Yeah, they're doing it with this. They're doing it with the new Coen Brothers movie, which is a big deal. And they've also got more stuff like that coming out.
Right. All right. Well, there you go. I had no idea. well, with that, we should draw this to a close. Thank you, Jordan, for coming on the show. Thank you, listener, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please do check out the other podcasts in the network and get more information about our own show by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes and like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/City of Man Podcast or shoot us an email at CityofManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.